You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Welcome, happy morning. Age to age shall say, hell today is vanquished, heaven is won today. May the words of my mouth, may the meditations of our hearts be always acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. One of the blessings of ministry, one of the gifts of ministry, is the opportunity to be invited into people's lives in significant moments, weddings and baptisms and funerals. And one wedding in particular stands out in my memory this morning. And let me say, they're all special. They're all equally special. But this one in particular stands out in my mind. And it was many years ago, and they were a delightful couple. They were engaged with one another. They were sincere and earnest in their preparation for marriage. They were gracious and loving. They were bright. They were both in the chemical and biomolecular engineering PhD program at Notre Dame. Forgive me, they had great chemistry. It's lame, but I couldn't help it. Thank you for indulging me in that. And they were a lovely couple. They were all together, engaged in the process, preparing for marriage. And I remember being at the service, and this was in my mind. I didn't articulate this, but as I looked at them and as they were exchanging their vows, what struck me in that moment was, they have no idea what they're getting into. None. They were earnest. They were engaged. They were bright. But they just there was no way for them to know what it was that they were getting into. And that's true of all of us. That's true of myself. That's true of anyone. But it's because it's relational. A marriage is relational. It's a living thing. And all of you know and experience whatever the relationship is, whether it's a marriage, whether it's a friendship, whether it's work relationships. When you enter into relationships, you have hopes and you have expectations and you have things that you long for and project onto that relationship. And I begin in that place this morning because Jesus's friends and followers had no idea what they were getting into. They had no idea when they began to follow him what it was that they were getting into. And one of the things over the years, I'll make a confession to you. For years, I was not a fan of Mark's gospel. I'll confess that's rather presumptuous. It did fine for millennia without my particular approval. But what I didn't like about Mark in particular was the account of the resurrection. I just thought, you know what, that's not the way Christians should act. Christians are confident, and Christians are filled with faith. And we hear, at least initially, in the account of the resurrection in Mark's gospel, that they fled in terror. But over the years, you didn't come to hear my issues, you're here for your own issues. But over the years, I've come to be a great fan of Mark's gospel. And one of the things that I love about it, as I've seen over time, is the truth, is the honesty of it. And the truth and the honesty are enabled by what they came to realize and to know about the person and the nature and the work of God in Jesus Christ. It enabled a freedom. It enabled an honesty about themselves. As you read through Mark's gospel, one of the things that stands out is, honestly, they're a mess. They squabble and they argue over who is going to be the greatest, and they're often slow to believe. It's often the outsiders who seem to recognize things before Jesus' closest followers do. But one of the things is, because of God and because of who God is, they're able to be honest. And why is that? It's because what they came to know about the way that they were loved fiercely, the way that they were redeemed, the way that they were forgiven. Those things change us. When we know that we're loved, when grace is extended to us, when forgiveness and reconciliation happen, it enables a security in us to be honest in a way that we're not afraid. We're able to be grateful. And one of the features of Mark's gospel, likely, is that Peter, is sharing with Mark the eyewitness accounts, the things that he had seen and that he had experienced. And both Peter and Mark both knew about failure, and they knew about redemption, and they knew about the insufficiency of their own performances. They knew what it was to experience in life that disequilibrium. How did I get here? How do I get out of that situation? And in the text this morning, we find that they who had made great promises, Jesus will be with you to the end, even if it means that we die, we won't forsake you, we will not leave you. And now we find that they've all fled and they are all hidden. And alone are Mary and Salome, and they make their way to the tomb. And as they make their way to the tomb, they are there on a funeral errand. They are preoccupied with death. They see no possibility of life. James Edwards has a wonderful quote on this, and he writes this: "They endeavor with their spices and anxieties to bring some kind of closure, however inadequate, to a tragic drama. But all their preparations leave them unprepared for the reality they encounter. What they intend to be a terminal visit is but a commencement. The Jesus they are looking for, enshrined in a safe place, cannot be found. The visit to the tomb is vintage mark and irony. The living are consumed with death, but the crucified one is consumed with life. They go, and their concern is who will roll away the stone. And of course, we see that the stone is rolled away that they might see, that they might know, that they might be witnesses, that you and I might see. And we see the fulfillment of Jesus' words. He says, I've come that you might have life, and that you might have life in the fullest. But the fullest life is relational, and they are invited to enter into that. I share a story with you, and this is from when I was first ordained, and it was the first Sunday after I had been ordained, and I was going to be celebrating the Eucharist for the first time, and I wanted it to go perfectly, not because I'm vain, but because I'm a Christian. It was for God and not for me that I wanted it to go perfectly. And it was at the cathedral in Charleston. We had an early service at 7:30, and it was in the chapel over to the side, and it came time to prepare the table and to pour the wine and the water into the chalice. There was one cruet, and I thought, well, it's just wine only and not water, and you see where this is going. I opened it up, and it's just water in there and no wine, and I just, you know, thank you for your confidence. It's unfounded. I'm going to be back in just a minute, and I had to go sort of, you know, make the long walk over there and over to the sacristy and bring back the wine and prepare. And I thought, well, all right, 7:30 is over, 10 o'clock is going to be better. And it came time for communion, and the dean had set the table, and all the bread was there. And this is such a churchy thing, but there's a larger piece of bread that we sometimes call the host, that you lift up and that you break at a particular moment. And when it came time for that, I couldn't find it anywhere. And I don't know, it was sort of ecclesiastical hazing or something. It was not there when it was supposed to be there. And so what I decided to do was I bowed very reverently, looking down at the table, and to no avail. And I came up again, and I thought, well, maybe I knocked it off, and so I genuflected. So I went down. And I'm looking underneath to see if I had knocked it off somewhere, and it's still not there. And so, one last try. So I sort of bowed reverently again, very, very low, and I saw the corner of it sticking out. The dean had piled all the other bread on top again. Funny. So I pulled it out, and again, this is, I know, silly, churchy, all that kind of good stuff, but I held it up, and I broke it, and in God's wonderful mercy, one of the things that was clear from the outset is that my security, that our security is not in my own performance. It's in the once and for all finished work of Jesus. It's in the performance of God, and not my own personal performance. We're not called We're given this amazing opportunity not to be winners, but witnesses. Not to be winners, but to be witnesses of what God has done and what God is doing. And after the service, as I was greeting people, one of the women said to me, "That was a really holy moment." And I thought about saying thank you. But I was like, no, let me go ahead and tell you what actually happened. But in thinking about it over time, it was a holy moment. Again, not because of anything that I did, but because of who God is, what God reveals of his nature and his character, what God has done and his cross and his resurrection. There is a quote in the front of the bulletin this morning, and likewise from James Edwards. And I mentioned to you, one of the things about Mark's gospel is that Peter is sharing with Mark his experiences in all of their honesty. And commenting, and if you listen to the gospel this morning, one of the things that is said to the women is this: "Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him, but go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee." And Edwards writes, I believe, quite rightly about this: "The angel's final word to the women is, tell Jesus, his disciples, and Peter, he is going ahead of you. There you will see him just as he told you. The announcement is a remarkable word of grace and encouragement. The flight of the disciples, even Peter's pitiful denial, have not been the last word. It is not given to human beings to speak the last word. The last word belongs to the risen Lord. I am going before you. The announcement of the angel is not one of deserved blame, but a promise of gathering and going before them. God completes his plans for the church despite human failure. At the word of grace from the resurrected Lord includes a traitor like Peter. Readers of the gospel may be assured that it includes those of their community who have also failed Christ." Our lives are wonderfully, profoundly, dramatically reoriented, no longer in our own failures or in our own successes. We see that there is a greater final word that has been spoken. It's a greater final word than death. It's a greater final word than diagnoses, than the things that we do and the things that we leave undone. There is holiness. There is a work of God which is ongoing. And we hear that wonderful word of good news spoken, that it's not given to you and to me to have the final word. The final word is given to the crucified and risen Jesus. And rather than a word of deserved rebuke, it's a gracious word. It's a gathering word. It's a life-giving word which is spoken to you and to me. And finally, this: I invite you to do something. It says, go and tell the disciples and Peter also. What I'd invite you to do is to scratch out the name of Peter and to place your own name there, because it's a word spoken not only to Peter, but it's a word spoken to you as well. A gracious, gathering, life-giving word. Our security, our life, our hope are given to us in the full and sufficient and final work of Jesus, crucified and risen, who has the final word, who speaks a final and powerful word into our lives. A gracious, gathering, life-giving word. Amen.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.